family that was tied in the affairs of men. We'll discover what that means shortly. For many, probably most of you, Mr. Kenyon needs no introduction, but I suspect that few of you will be familiar with Mr. Kenyon's fascinating career, so I'll just say a little bit about it. Mr. Kenyon was the grandson of a Manx archdeacon on his mother's side and the son of a clergyman with Lancashire roots. He was born and brought up in Yorkshire. On leaving school in 1925, Mr. Kenyon started working life as an apprentice in Wakefield with the famous wool company Paton's and Baldwin's. Before long, he was transferred to the export department of the head office in Halifax and thence to the company's office in Shanghai in China, where he was to live for the next 22 years. In 1937, Mr. Kenyon was married at St. Andrew's Cathedral in Singapore, and he and his late wife celebrated their golden wedding in 1987. The war saw Mr. Kenyon interned by the Japanese, and after the war, he experienced the turmoil of the communist takeover of Shanghai. In 1948, it was back to England as a director of the company which he had joined as an apprentice, and of which he was later to become the managing director. In 1970, Mr. Kenyon retired to the Isle of Man, to live in Ramsey, not so far from where his parents had been married at Kirkandres in April 1907. Retirement, however, is not the right word, as Mr. Kenyon has been active in many spheres of Manx life, in the church, in government, as president of the Raven Club in Ramsey, and as treasurer and chairman of the president of the Friends of the Manx Museum, serving the Friends for a total of some 18 years. And all the while following his great interest in Manx family history. And it is that interest which is the subject of this evening's talk. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to welcome Mr. Stoel Kenyon.
Am I on the air? Good. Get my best glasses out. Mr. Chairman, members of the Manx Conservation Trust, my Lord Bishop, ladies and gentlemen. Some of those, it's a bit bright here, can I have it down a bit, please? Some of those, thank you, who heard this talk originally were kind enough to write to me that the result was a portrayal of Manx social history in an easily digestible form. And it is in that context that I'm trying to present it to you tonight. I gave my talk the title A Family That Was because I've used the Great War as a convenient cut-off point. I don't believe in going on in history until the present day because history changes. One day Margaret Thatcher's a great woman and the next day she's an ouch, you know. My subtitle is adapted from Julius Caesar. There's a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. In these closing days of the 20th century, the word fortune does not always denote worthy or honorable achievement. I prefer the word fame. It's a noun which encompasses the widest spectrum of man's achievement and is equally applicable to Chelsea Killier, Captain Quilliam, or T.E. Brown, and many hundreds of Manx men and women have achieved fame. Most Manx men and women have been too innately conservative and perhaps reticent to make a very large fortune. So let us take a look at a typical Manx farming family about whom there happens to be a certain amount of information of the first 200 years and a great deal of information about the last 250. And in particular, let us try to sort out what influences and at what period in time the younger members of each generation were stimulated to strike out for themselves away from the farm and to examine what direction they took. Still haven't got this right, it's a bit better. I was reading a conventional Manx family tree. You know the sort with the ancestor at the top, a little vertical line, and a long line here of all the sons and daughters, and lots of little vertical lines of their children. Dates of birth and death were there. In the island's earlier days, baptisms and funerals, of course, as were the names of wives, that, but not always of husbands. As a journey through the ages, it was doubtless accurate and certainly of interest as a record. But what sort of people were they? How did they live? What did many of them do for a living? And of those whose destiny took them far from their roots, what influences had been at work therein? I reflected upon the first 17 verses of St. Matthew's Gospel. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judah and his brethren, and so on via Abinadab, Boaz, and Jesse, to David, 14 generations. Now, I knew quite a lot more about some of these characters than I knew about the folk in the family tree. David had slain the giant Goliath, had written some of the Psalms, and had taken to wife Bathsheba under somewhat dubious circumstances. In short, a man of many parts. As for Judah and his brethren, Andrew Lloyd Webber had immortalized the career and clothing of the one and the treachery of 10 of the others. And I was determined to have a shot at putting some flesh onto some Manx bones and in the process to learn a bit more about the island and its history. Had I started today, I could have saved some time. Lost it? Never mind. I could have saved some time and avoided several blind alleys. It's not vital, but if you decide to have a go at looking back, start by buying Janet Narasimhan's booklet called The Manx Family Tree, A Beginner's Guide. And don't forget a few basic facts. Most parish registers record baptisms, not births, and burials, not deaths. Don't expect to find anything before 1600. And be chary of the change in the New Year's Day, because up to 1753, this was March the 25th, and after that, it became the 1st of January. And so you could get a very awkward impression from a record of someone who was married in May and appeared to have had a child in February the year earlier. The manorial rolls of 1511 and 1515 mark the beginning of records of property and tenants, essentially farming, and form the start of J.J. Neen's Manx place names. So buy a copy or consult your local library. If your farm is in that, you are a long way on. You may be able to discern the year 1515 there, and you may be able to discern the tree in Dorby there. You will notice also that the language is in Latin. As you search, please don't have illusions of grandeur. Manx society has always been yeoman-based rather than patrician. Now, our chosen family comes from German, so what can we find out about them? Their farm canet, can you see it at all? Because I can't. Their farm canet is in the middle of the magnifying glass. That, I hope, is Peel. And that is the treen of Balacabeg, though differently spelled. What does Nene say? Canet, 1515 manorial rolls, John Mackie. This would be a bad start, except for the following passage in William Cubbon's Island Heritage. The Gaels of Canet come from an old stock. The quarterland of that name was held by the Gael and Quine families from 1630 and possibly earlier. And the earliest recorded ancestor of both families was John Mackie, 1515. This, if it comes up, is the manorial row page. Well, for Balacabeg. Left margin, I suppose somewhere here, I don't know where we are, quite, I presume this Peel, but differently spelled. But further help comes from a conventional family tree compiled by a descendant who became a Deemster. And it starts off with John Gell, owner of Canet, German, 1515, died 15 blank. Finlow Gell of Canet died about 1593. John McGell of Canet, that doesn't look to me the right one at all. Should be a family tree, please. John McGill of Canet died about 16 blank, and John McGill of Canet died October 1680. You will notice some have little green spots, and they are the ones who are mentioned in this talk. It was soon apparent that until the 17th century, one cannot state with any certainty 'twas thus and thus they lived. But a generalized picture is, however, probably close to reality. Blundell, as late as 1656, described a Manx cottage, and here you are with an early impression, as a mere hovel. In this smoking hut doth the man, his wife, and children cohabit, and in many cases, with the ducks and geese under the bed, the cocks and hennies over his head, and the cow and calfy at the bed's foot. Until 1583, the fields were generally unfenced, boundaries frequently being delineated by stones. Hence the origin of the sentence and the commination service, cursed is he that removeth his neighbor's landmark. There were no roads usable by wheel traffic. And this may surprise some of you. Until the Act of 1713, the chief highways had always been uneven grass tracks, secondary roads being often little distinguishable from the ground through which they wandered. The commonest mode of transport of goods as late as the 18th century was by a creel slung on a man's back or by a horse with a creel called a straddle. And not until 1713 did wheeled vehicles gradually come into use. And I quote from A.W. Moore, page 446, where he's quite explicit. there were no wheeled vehicles except a carriage used by Bishop Wilson in his later years. And the only place he could use it was on the sands near Kirkmichael. Now, since that was written, further information has come to light, and for strict accuracy, Miss Harrison tells me that she has found reference to two vehicles, one of them owned by an Ulster knight called Sir Robert Kennedy, sometime in the 1680s. And presumably Sir Robert Kennedy could only either get about the environs of Castletown, small though they would be relatively, and Douglas, which I imagine would be even smaller. So the answer was, if you didn't have a horse, you had to walk. Very strict church rules and heavy punishment for non-compliance made a horse kept for riding to church, or for that matter to market, a virtual necessity. Until 1713, that's very, very much later, but until 1713, there was no church at Patrick. And so you have to envisage successive gels making their way, pillion style, from the Hope to the chapel of St. Peter of Hometown after about 1600, and presumably before then to one of the two churches in the island of that name. What is certain is that these earliest gels would be riding to Mass. The isolation and remoteness of the island meant that change following the Reformation was slow. After all is said and done, Lord Derby was interested in collecting rents. And the last Catholic bishop did not resign until 1559. Nor was there a regular succession of Protestant bishops until John Phillips in 1604, which is nearly 60 years after the Reformation. W.S. Dempsey, in his book Story of the Catholic Church in the Isle of Man, states quite bluntly, the expulsion of the monks led to widespread illiteracy. Perhaps I think it would be more accurate to say delayed the growth of literacy by at least a century. Canet was roughly 80 acres. It rose by the year 1700 to 130 acres, and by 1867, which is the date of Wood's famous atlas, to over 163 acres. Crops were rotated on the three-year system. One field each of oats, corn, or barley, and one lying fallow. And fortunately, fertilizer in the form of lime, seaweed, and dung was happily close to hand. Cattle grazed in the open throughout the year, and there were few trees other than the thorn. Now, that is Peel, as early as you can get any sort of impression. I think that's a Warwick Smith, but I'm not sure. It's another thing that may surprise you. In 1511, Peel had only 19 houses with, say, 100 inhabitants, bearing 16 surnames. And 12 of these surnames were English, and only 4 Manx. By 1726, it had risen to 475 persons. So, in brief, for the first 200 years, we know little about daily life at Canet, and I doubt if a great deal is known about the other residents of the parish of German either. But great changes took place in the island in the 17th century. Firstly, Bishop Phillips, being a Welshman, do I detect anything in the Episcopal line? Being a Welshman and therefore keenly interested in the Manx language, had translated the prayer book into Manx. He put his clergy to work making copies, and here is a page from one of them. I want to try and pick it up here in a second. Lal Namakan means festival of the little sun, and this is the collect for the third day after Christmas, Holy Innocents Day. As you can see in the middle of the page, I hope, where? There, Lal Namakan en collect. The importance of the Phillips Prayer Book is that it was the first ever Manx language book. Hitherto, the liturgy had been in Latin. Then, all of a sudden, it was in English, and neither was intelligible to the population, or most of the population. Now, Bishop Barrow, 1663 to 71, by somewhat ruthless means, raised a fund to send young men to universities, especially Dublin, the nearest and the cheapest. No portraits exist of Phillips or Barrow, and so we show here Bishop Rutter, who came between them, and who incidentally was with the Countess of Derby in the siege of Castle Rushen by the Commonwealth. Forgive me while I have a little drink. In Rutter's day, the 8th Earl made it compulsory for all his tenants to attend school. And the arrival shortly afterwards of Bishop Wilson in 1698 swiftly led to improved parochial schools and, for some, the chance to go to the academic school at Castletown, shown here anticipating somewhat the electric light up in the roof installed by Manx Heritage. Or they could go about the same time or shortly afterwards to a grammar school in Douglas. Nearly simultaneously, the Act of Settlement, negotiated between Bishop Wilson and the 10th Earl, meant that all farmers, gels among them, now became perpetual leaseholders instead of merely being tenants at the Lord's pleasure. Now, the gel who succeeded to Canet when his father died in 1706 was only 9 years old. His mother had remarried. Where is he? 1706, there. His mother had remarried and thereby added a small holding close moor to Canet. But the importance is that Canet was now gel property. It belonged to them. And to find her son a suitable wife to secure the future became of importance. The marriage took place in July 1715, and the importance to both bridegroom and bride may be gleaned from a lengthy marriage settlement, of which the final page is shown here, dated the 19th of January 1714, somewhere here. Mary Quirk's dowry was to be £9, and her father and mother undertook to help work Canet with a curious provision, and that was that if Mary should die childless within 4 years of the marriage, her parents should receive payment for work done by them during that period. It is a reminder that the Manx countryside was still illiterate. To see that seven members, I'm probably not seeing this as well as you are, seven members of the Gell and Quirk and Quines family all had to make their mark. And that really the only signatures there were those of the priest and the deemster. I can see Finlow Quirk, for instance, there, and Thomas Kerfey and so on. But the family all had to make their mark. But from now on, their children and grandchildren were going to become able not only to speak English, but also to acquire the three R's. These were days of rapid expansion in the island. David Crane writes, "A number of commercial adventurers settled in Man from England, having realized the opportunities of lawful and illicit trade offered by the island's position and low duties." Are we talking 20th century or the 16th or the 18th? David Robertson, writing in 1794, however, reminds us in the following remark: "To the society of the English, Douglas is considerably indebted. They have contributed to polish the manners of the natives." The Manx-born descendant of one of these comeovers was George Moore, seen here in early middle age, who settled in Peel, where he waxed rich and famous. By the age of 36, Gell, husband of Mary Quirk, was himself polished enough to be nominated one of four men to apportion seats in the church as near as possible to the places belonging to the parishioners as of ancient right. George Moore was then only 24, having taken it for granted that he was on the side of the angels, did not hesitate to bargain for the most desirable seat in St. Peter's, the first on the south side of the altar, in return for the gift of a new church bell, costing £6, 1 shilling and 8 pence. John Gell Kinney, the parish records state, was allotted seat number 4 in the south aisle, spelt I-S-L-E. John and Mary had 9 children, and the Kinney heir, like those before and all those following, was called John, succeeded in 1758. He followed in father's footsteps by being sworn in as churchwarden of Kirk German on the 17th of July, 1782. And we shall meet shortly the youngest son of this large family, who was to found a totally new line. A vital development for German folk in particular had been the establishment of a free school in Peel known as the Clothworkers School, by reason of its founder, Philip Christian, a native of Peel, who had gone to London and prospered as a clothworker there and who died in 1652. And I think it's fair to make an assumption that the generation of Gells just coming up were educated there and got the chance of going places. Now the senior, there's the clothworker school. Now the senior of the new generation did not marry until 46. And when he did, and I want you just to note here how so many of these chaps, they looked around for a wife who could give them a lift up with the bootstraps. When he did, he married Elizabeth Madrill, the sister of the vicar of Kirkcaldy, who was 17 years younger than he. Between 1793 and 1804, they had 10 children, and the eldest of whom, Margaret, married John Clucas of Ballachilia and became the mother of John Thomas Clucas of 19th century eminence. All except one of the brothers left the farm for commercial life, no doubt inspired by the success of George Moore and his contemporaries, and don't forget the sale of the Athol rights to the English crown. One boy, William, seen here, settled in Douglas as a chemist on Custom House Quay and sold an astonishing variety of goods from possets to rum. Another boy, Robert, became a tanner. He lodged with a widow, Eleanor Keg, who kept a Douglas public house. And Goodwin's manuscript, and those who don't know it have lost something, you want to try and get a glimpse of it, a fascinating record of fact and tittle-tattle, remarks acidly, he borrowed money from her to pay for his raw material, and he never repaid her, but persuaded her to marry him. And on her death, he got all her money and turned Keg's own children adrift. The widow Keg and Robert Gell had one child. Here you see the end of what I was just quoting from. He persuaded her to marry him. On her death, he got all her money and turned Keg's children adrift. They had to seek a living as servants. The daughter of this marriage, Elizabeth, owned, I originally put in built, and then I thought Miss Harrison would probably catch me out, so I changed it to owned, Anfield Hay, am I right, in Victoria Road, anyway, it's in that area, Anfield Hay, Douglas. And this became a sort of base for many cousins, contemporary and subsequently. The youngest brother, Evan Gell, was more respectable than Robert. He became a brewer at Glenwillin. He prospered. He owned the inn at Kirkmichael. He looks more respectable, doesn't he, too? He owned the inn at Kirkmichael. He lived at the White House and became, in the words of Manx worthies, one of the principal insular breeders of shorthorns. A member of the House of Keys, J.P. and captain of the parish. He is commemorated by a plaque in the south transept of Kirkmichael Church, and on his death, the White House was sold to Diamond Joe Milchreist. Meantime, their father too had expanded his interests beyond farming. In 1795, he received £126.05 10d. British for work done in the rebuilding of St. John's Chapel, and was commemorated by a Herculaneum pottery jug, transfer printed with his name and a picture of Kinnaigh Farm, that is on the side there, which is in the Manx Museum. And I was disappointed to see Miss Harrison is not in the end gallery where all the posters are. You've got a smaller jug. You want to swap it. Where are we? In 1816, John Gell also owned a few properties in Douglas, which he let out for rent. Now, John and his wife in their old age were confronted with a dynastic problem. Not only had their four youngest sons all become established in businesses elsewhere, but their eldest son, James, who should have followed at Kinnaigh, never married, and died age 40, 2 years before his father. And what was even worse, the second boy, John, who had married well and sired three sons, had, in Goodwin's words, become a painter or joiner in Liverpool. And there he too had died, aged 32, 6 years before his brother James. Now, the widow had been born Margaret McCutcheon. She's shown here in old age. She was the sister of the Deemster of that age. And on the death of her family, she returned to the island. But as her eldest boy was not yet 15 when his grandfather died, Kinney clearly had to be let to tenants, though passing by inheritance to John. And this young man, there he is, a little bit later, of course, this young man found himself the head of a family of some modest stature, albeit running into money problems. He became a justice of the peace, captain of the parish of Jermyn, and a co-opted member of the House of Keys. And after the general suffrage reform of 1866, was duly elected to continue to serve. We get some idea of the advance from the days of John Mackie Cottage by an extract from his funeral notice. This highly respected gentleman died on Sunday last at Kinney House. Note the house that was originally a farm and before that a stinking hovel. The funeral cortege consisted of upwards of 40 vehicles and many pedestrians. His death is regretted by all who enjoyed his friendship when living. An equally guileless and hospitable man, it would be hard to find. And perhaps the closing words are the clue to the clouds which began to gather over Kinney, now encumbered by debts. He was only 49 when he died in 1870, and his eldest son not quite 18, and the family was rapidly moving away from farm life. Kinney was now in the hands of trustees to hold and discharge his father's debts, so John went off to Manchester and married an English girl. And the trust was not discharged until 1918, 48 years later. And throughout this period, Kinney was tenanted. So shortly afterwards, it was put up for auction. It started at £4,000 and was knocked down for £4,350 to a Mr. J.H. Clark. Happily, Clark was revealed to be acting for John's cousin, Philip Thomasgale, the son of his father's youngest brother. There were three brothers, if you remember. Philip Gale, the uncle, had emigrated to New Zealand and made enough money to secure the family heritage. And a tenant, Mr. J.T. Cameen, was found for Kinney and his grandson, farms the house, the farm still today. Philip Gale never married, but he had a brother, Dr. Jack McCutcheon Gale, who died aged 42 in 1903 and left a tiny orphan daughter, later to become known as Miss Mary Gale of Riversdale, Lezaire. And Philip bequeathed her Kinney. She in turn, on her death in 1964, Christmas Eve, left Kinney to the senior male bearer of the Gale name. The present John Gale, shown here at his wedding in 1961, lives in England. Mr. Cameen is his tenant. The property is now around 150 acres, And by 1972, there were only 9 males bearing the Gell name left alive. In this shot of the Canet farmyard, you see the present Mr. Kameen talking to someone whose appearance is vaguely familiar there. So I now want to go back in time to the youngest of the children of John Gell, whom I mentioned, Henry Gell, who was to found a whole new line. Born in, oh, there's Canet farmyard again. And if we can see it, it has a lovely distinction that those pillars are round. The stonework is built in a circle. Are we away from the farm yet, Mr. Operator? Henry, born in 1766, grew up, therefore, in the early post-revestment period, and he would be ambitious to obtain a well-paid job under the British Crown. On leaving school, he joined the customs service as a jerker and passmaster, amongst whose duties it was to search for contraband. Now there's Henry I'm talking about. The vicar of German, note another parson, was closely involved with the port. In the statutes of 1810, it was declared, as the herring fishing is as great a blessing as any the island receives, the vicar or minister shall repair to the harbour every morning and evening to read divine service and deliver good admonition, upon default of which he shall lose his tithe of fish for the ensuing night to be given to the poor at the admiral's discretion, and any person who omits to come to prayers is excluded from fishing that night. And that was the poor fleet in a storm, and that a little bit later date was the fleet in harbour. The museum possesses a facsimile copy of the Reverend Henry Corlett's journal for 1767. The fish tithe was an important part of Corlett's income, and I want to quote 2 entries. The price of fish is quoted per cran. July the 11th, where are we? Fish 2 and 8 pence. I can't see it at the moment. Yes, there. Fish 2 and 8 pence. And if you can read it, I can't from this distance, but I'll read it to you. This day I was grossly insulted on the shore, the boats afloat, by James Lace of Peeltown, cooper and boatmaster, only for demanding my tithe. Tom Kane sided him. Note, Kane cursed and swore. I reproved him. July the 21st, read prayers at 7 o'clock on the quay, the Admiral, Thomas Costain, and Flag. At 2 o'clock, read evening prayer. Note, for refusing to come to prayers and for saucy language, the Admiral took away the rudder of the Shigley's boat, St. Andrew. The vicar had 2 daughters. One of them, Marcia, was a woman of great character and courage. She is incidentally in Manxworthy's. E.F. Pollard's biography of her grandson recounts how in a Peel smallpox epidemic, she comforted the dying and nurtured their orphans, thus learning the lessons she taught her own little ones. In one such epidemic, can you get it right? Well, okay, it's probably all right down there. In one such epidemic, 1772 to 73, over a 7-month period, the parish register records 86 burials, 70 of whom were smallpox. And this at a time when Peel had only 210 married couples and the rest of the parish of German 169. And here are 2 pages from that journal, and all marked with those spots died of smallpox. And incidentally, the vicar of German gave me five more slides for the museum's retention, if they wish, with another five pages of tragedy. Henry Gell married Marcia in 1790, and they had nine sons, two of whom died in infancy. They lived in Market Street, opposite the grammar school, and next to Morrison's shop. The links between Peel and the sea and the determination of two ambitious parents ensured that four sons went to sea. Two became captains on the Liverpool West Indies run. A third perished in the Bay of Bengal. Their third son, however, went into the church, and their youngest son emigrated to Sicily. And I want to take him first. He was called Joseph. He had married another parson's daughter, Charlotte Stephen, the younger daughter of the vicar of Patrick. And her sister had married a Balaf man, Thomas Corlett of Cavalia. The Manx were familiar with Sicily. Not only was its crest like theirs, the three legs, but they were beginning to trade, and here is the brig Caesar sailing in some waters, which I know not, but that looks to me as though it might be Mount Etna. That's 1783, the brig Caesar was built. But there was a connection between Sicily and the island because a Liverpool businessman, Woodhouse by name, had strong connections with the herring kippering industry on the island and had gone to Sicily in 1770 for the double purpose of buying raw materials for the manufacture of soda and also in search of a less expensive substitute for port and Madeira.